We are actually talking about short selling this morning. We got John DelVecchio. He's the author of What's Behind the Numbers. And he has worked with some of the greats. I will say David Tice, who I guess is the granddaddy of short selling, and some of the others. But you are...
I refer to him as the granddaddy of modern short sellers.
And, I mean, you were one of the most successful short sellers around now, John. And, Charles, you posed a question to him right before the break, and unfortunately, we had to cut him off.
Yeah, so, you know, being a short seller is tough because the usual movement of the market is up. You know, the market, more often than not, is rising. So if your specialty is profiting from stocks that fall, you're always kind of going against the grain. You know, that's a tough business to be in. It's why short sellers tend to be very independent, independently minded, and really quite smart. But, you know, John, what would you comment on that? You know, you started to talk about it in the last segment. How does a short seller make money when the market's rising?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, there's a study called the Capital Distribution that you can go get for free on the internet that I think is fascinating. It's mostly charts, so it's pretty easy to understand. But from 1983 to 2007, the market, as measured by the Russell 3000, was up about 900%. So the wind was pretty much at your back in owning stocks. However, only 25% of the stocks accounted for all of the market's gains, and only about 6% of the stocks were up like 1,500% or more, like the really big winners, whereas 20% of the stocks were down by 75% or more. The average stock was flat. And if you think about that, and it's a good title, the capitalism distribution. In capitalism, you have one winner and a lot of losers. So there's one Microsoft, and there's a lot of companies that, you know, were in that space in the early to mid-1980s that don't exist anymore.
A lot of companies that you or I would even struggle to name because they've been lost to history at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, where's WordPerfect today? Does anybody even use that? You know, I don't know. But,
it's in a museum, I believe.
What's that?
I think it might be in a museum somewhere.
yeah, exactly. So if we were here talking in the 1970s, and I said, well, in 30 years, General Motors is going to be bankrupt. You know, GE would be down 90%. Polaroid would be out of business. Eastman Kodak would pretty much be out of business. That would pretty much sound crazy and not be blasphemous. And that's basically what happened, you know. So you have leaders from one generation in the market are generally not the leaders of the next. So today it's social media, the Facebooks and the Alphabets and to a certain degree Apples of the world, and they're probably not going to be the leader in the next cycle. So that's where the opportunity lies.
Yeah, very good.
Go ahead, Charles.
We mentioned before, you know, you're the, you know, the Horatio Caine of finance here. You know where to look for the evidence. You know where to, you know, you know where the bodies are buried. And most of us know, you know, most even, you know, casual investors know that earnings numbers really aren't to be trusted. I mean, there's a lot of room for manipulation with, you know, non-cash expenses, this, that, and the other. But most people would generally view revenues and sales as a safer number to hang your hat on. But one of your specialties is actually looking for aggressive revenue recognition and looking for potential red flags there in the revenue and sales number themselves. Could you go into some detail on that?
Yeah, that's right. So because earnings can be manipulated, the price-to-sales ratio was created in the early 1980s by Ken Fisher, who wrote a book called Superstock. And Fisher has been a contributor to Forbes for 30 or 40 years. And a lot
he
of
built
people
his practice
follow,
on that, yeah.
Yeah, so a lot of people started following that measure. And then I actually went to go work for a man named James O'Shaughnessy, who wrote a book called What Works on Wall Street in the late 1990s when I was still in college. And he repopularized that measure because he found that over decades that was a great valuation tool. But once I started to get into forensic accounting, I really learned that there's a lot of ways that management teams can manipulate the top line. And the reason why it's such a profitable source of finding ideas is that it doesn't matter what product or service they sell. If management is engaging in aggressive revenue recognition, then the demand for their product is probably fading. There's no reason to go to the top line if there's so many other ways to manipulate the financials. So once they go there, it's like catching them with their hand in the cookie jar. And a classic example is just offering a customer an incentive to sign a contract today that would be signed at a later date. And by doing that, they booked the revenue now, whereas they would have booked it a revenue forward. The problem is now they need to go find a new customer to replace the one they just stole from the future and brought into the present. And it's just a great way of showing that there's a slowdown in the business. Everything flows from revenue down. All the financial statements really are generated from there, because the first line item in a cash flow statement is earnings. So yeah, the top line of the income statement is revenue. So everything works off of that. So if you can find management teams that are aggressive in that line item, that's and I would, there's no doubt in my mind, historically, those have been my most profitable investments on the short side of the company.
Well, and it's an area you sort of have to yourself. I mean, not so much now, but for the longest time, nobody was really looking at that. You know, they were looking at other areas on the income statement. Nobody was really looking at aggressive revenue recognition. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, that's a good spot for you. You know, what are some good fishing ponds? I mean, probably, you know, some sectors are a little more susceptible to this than others, or, you know, some are more cyclical than others. You know, where do you go? Like, what sectors do you normally go to? Where do you find these kind of opportunities?
So my two favorite ones would be technology and consumer-oriented businesses. People get very excited about technology, so they tend to overestimate the success of those businesses, and technology companies almost always hit a bump in the road. So the question is management open and honest about that, or do they try to paste over that with some sort of accounting shenanigans? And that's when you can catch them red-handed right there. Consumer businesses, you know, we're all consumers, so we can relate better to those. They're easier to understand. And those companies also get in trouble by pushing a lot of products in the marketplace. We had a very big short position in Under Armour. We're no longer in that. But that's a company that had a huge buildup in inventory, and they pushed a lot of products into the market. So the receivables are starting to rise, and it was basically taking them longer to collect that cash. And when demand slowed down, there's all that inventory in the channel. It needs to be sold off at discounted prices. That hurts your margin, lower margins for earning.
Inventory, and that's something that I find very interesting, because you can draw the wrong conclusions there. If you see a company building up inventory, that could be bullish if they're building up inventory in expectation of big sales. But it could also be very bearish, because if they're building up too much inventory, then they might have to sell it at a fire sale price, and that affects margins and everything else. So you're the forensic accountant. You tell me, what's the difference? How do you know when an inventory buildup is good and when it's bad?
So there's two ways that we look at it. We look at the construction of the inventory. So is it raw materials? Is it work in process? Is it finished goods? And we look at the inventory buildup relative to the estimated sales going forward. So we're trying to take into account that if there is a new product launch, obviously companies are going to build up inventory in anticipation of pushing that out on the market and generating revenue. However, if that inventory buildup starts to become a larger component of future revenues relative to the past, then that's a big warning. So that's kind of how we end.
So not all inventory is created equal.
Definitely not. Nope.
Well, we're going to have to step in. We're going to have to take another break, guys. John, if you can stay with us, I actually have some questions coming in from the audience via email.
Sure.
And also, we now know what sectors you're short in. I'd be interested to find out if there are some sectors that you're long in as well. You're listening to Straight Talk Money, bringing you the wisdom of Wall Street. Peggy Tuck, Charles Sizemore, John Del Vecchio. We're going to be back after these very important messages.
Still my guitar, gently weeps. I don't know why nobody told me.